All right, so we've been talking about validity in the selection process, and ultimately then what we're looking to do, of course, is to increase validity, get that straight line running through the two quadrants appropriately so that we have a selection process that is most beneficial to the organization and that we are not making mistakes and missing good people. We want to have a selection process that finds the good people and allows us to get them into the organization. So, talking about the validation process of a selection tool, it can be interviews or application blanks or tests or whatever it might happen to be. We need to validate those parts of a selection test that are there to eliminate people who we think are not going to be useful to the organization. So each component, this was hammered out in some cases, which I won't burden you with, but each component of a selection process needs to be validated. The alternative was to go give all these little tests within the validation process to see whether or not it was useful at the end, right, that you were getting good people. But in general, the courts want you to do each part of the process so that you do not illegally discriminate. Their concern was that in the end, you might have the right percentages out of your applicant pool, but that during the process, you might be illegally discriminating. In other words, you got rid of a whole bunch of whites with a non-job related test. Then you got rid of a whole bunch of Hispanics for the non-job related test, but in the end it balanced out appropriately, so that would be bad. And so they were not accepting the idea of validating the process at the end. They want you to validate each component of the selection test. All right, so now, with that in mind, I'll actually lumber to my feet and do something. So we're talking here about validation of the selection test. Now, in this, I mean the individual selection test. For example, the PRG interview. Or psychological, PSYCHOLOGICAL test. So each component needs to be investigated. These are people. Now look, how many people are missing? Oh, good kids. You're on top of it. Yeah, God, everybody's missing. What's going on? And here they are. Oh, I'm going to call out names so you're embarrassed. Okay.
It happened today and last class.
Really? You're a chronic misser. All right. So we're going to put together, hopefully, a selection test that's valid, whatever the test happens to be. Well, there is a simple way. But not court-supported. S-U-P-P-O-R-T-E-D. My handwriting is even worse than normal because it's been a blog splitter all day. Just not court-supported. The simple process is this. The simple process is known as concurrent validation. Concurrent validation process, and this is the actual term, concurrent validation process, concurrent methodology. In a concurrent methodology, we have a test that we think will be predictive of future job performance, right? And we test it on our, fill in the blank, employees. Good, right? It's up here, current, right? Right here. We test the proposed applicant test on our current employees. So let's say we have some sort of psychological test or whatever, and we would test it on our current employees during a lunch break or whatever it might happen to be. And then we would take scores from current EMS employee, DES, right, and compare those scores to what? No. What do I have?
Job performance.
Job performance, right, their performance appraisals. Compared to their performance appraisals. Well, I'm just writing PAs, but you know what it means. So we're going to compare their test scores of our current employees, and since they're current employees, we have performance appraisal scores, and we can do a correlation to see if there's a strong relationship between this test and their performance appraisal scores. Everybody see this? Pretty straightforward. Easy to do. We got the test. We give it to those employees we have, our current employees. You got to see there, right? And we get the scores, and we compare those scores to their performance appraisal, and that equals a correlation or not. And we can decide whether or not we want to use this test to select incoming applicants. Pretty straightforward. You can see how easy it is. That's a C for current employees. Okay. The problem with this is, and I won't make too big a fuss about it, but from a statistical point of view, we have what's known as range restriction. Range restriction means that you don't have much data to use. So you would have here, if this is our scores on the test, and this is our performance appraisal, the criterion, remember? If this is the criterion over here, we want to predict future performance appraisal. When you use your current employees, where do you think the data is going to be clustered?
On the positive side?
Yeah, on the top side, their scores would probably be high and their performance would be high. So we're going to have all of our employees, you're going to be up in here. What happened to our other employees? Pardon? They were fired, let go, quit, whatever, because they weren't being rewarded by the system. In a normal situation, we would expect data all through here in a linear trend, but since we're using existing employees, we have what's known as range restriction. And it's hard to get an accurate measure, an accurate correlation, which of course is a linear trend, when you only have limited data to draw that line from. Do you follow me? So, this idea of range restriction here, is a very normal problem when you use your current employees. Everybody else isn't there. Yeah?
Is that the main reason why it's not supported by the courts?
The main reason statistically. The other part is more sort of the situation. The situation is using existing employees is not the same as using incoming applicants. They're not the same people. Some people, these people already have a large experience with the job and may have picked up the necessary skills to do the job test correctly, whereas the applicants, right, don't have much familiarity with the job. So it's just not a good fit. So the concurrent methodology is something that I would sotto voice, you know, lower voice, tell you to go ahead and use, but with the understanding that you would not want to try to defend yourself in court against an adverse impact claim, job relatedness, when you use this concurrent process. The judge will just poke a hole in it and say, you know, I'm not doing it. All right. So instead, what you need to do is to put together a different process than all of this, which is much more expensive, much more complicated, and your results are time delayed substantially. You don't get the results right away. And that's the predictive methodology.
So that civil way doesn't use very much.
Pardon?
Because it can't be backed up. It's not used very much because it's not backed up.
Concurrent, it's used all the time because it's easy. But And I would encourage you to do the same things, you know, at a lower voice, not make a big deal about it. Use it, but then recognize that it's not going to stand up in court. And so you would want to go ahead and use predictive methodology, if at all possible, to confirm your findings that the concurrent methodology was okay or not okay. And then go from there. And you'll see why you need something, or at least should be thinking about something. This predictive method, then, has a lot of unattractive features to it, but it's what the court wants, and I understand why. Predictive methodology means that you have applicants, and you give them the test. I'll put here the new test. New test, the one that you're interested in validating. How good is this test at predicting future job performance? And that's what you're asking. Okay. Then you would ignore these results, ignore results. In fact, just file them away with a person's name on it, file them away. Ignoring the results, you would then use your existing or maybe even the concurrent methodology that you found to be useful, whatever it is. Maybe you found a concurrent test that's pretty predictive of job performance, so you would perhaps use that here. It's okay there. The court's not going to give you any grief about using it here. So then you would go ahead like this, and you'd bring those people in. They might give you some grief, but in general, this is going to be fine. Then out here, right, you're going to have maybe 6 months. Then, after 6 months of working on the job, you've made hiring using whatever method you want. 6 months later, everybody's learned the job, or maybe 2 months later, just some number, whatever, that takes to learn the job. You would then compare their performance appraisal after learning the job and doing it for a while, compare that performance appraisal to the new test scores that you had accumulated in the filing cabinet and had not used to select anyone. So, what this means here is these scores are not useful immediately. They're not useful until 6 months later when we compare them to the performance appraisal that these people have accumulated after 6 months. You follow this okay?
Would you compare it to the same people before they were employed and then after 6 months? They take it again and you compare
no,
the drill?
No, they would not take it again.
Okay.
You just take it. This would be the time, in theory, that you would actually make a decision about whether to hire somebody.
Mm.
So they're asking you to do that, keep the scores in a filing cabinet, don't use them for anything at this point, until you get a group of people who hopefully aren't range restricted, and go ahead and pull them out here. When you get those performance appraisals after X number of months, I just say six, you would then do a correlation between this proposed test and the actual performance appraisal which they achieved.
Okay.
Do you see?
So do you hire people off their scores, but then later on you're comparing it to PA to know if it's valid?
What we're doing is hiring based on our existing test methodology, which we're going to get rid of here as soon as we find a better test. And this hopefully is the better test. So we're hiring based on this. And out there, after some period of time when we have their performance appraisal, we'll compare it to that new proposed test that we're thinking about using. And if it looks like it has a decent correlation, we'll go ahead and use it. Okay?
If it's not, you've got to take a new test and do it all
over again. Yeah, all over again. That's why I told you you wouldn't like it.
So initially, if I'm like, just listen, you make a new company, you have to make a concurrent test to make an existing one to compare it to?
Here's the loophole. The loophole is that you can go to manufacturers of selection tests. The manufacturer of selection tests will supply you with the psychometrics, which is to say the statistical measures of the reliability and the validity. And the validity in the case that someone's selling you this test will be of this predictive methodology, not concurrent. At that point, if you're starting a new company, let's say for example, you would buy a test which has a strong predictive measure for the type of employee you're hiring. You're hiring salespeople or you're hiring whatever. They have tests that are geared for this type of job. And you would go ahead and use that based on the psychometrics that you are you're comfortable with. So it says, let's say you go to buy a test, and you buy a test that has a correlation to future job performance at, let's say, 0.35 or 4, some 0.4 maybe. It's pretty good. It's not great, and it's not as good as what I'm going to talk to you about here in a minute, but it's still acceptable. And I mentioned, did I mention to you before about my dissertation with those people? That a dissertation, when I worked on garments, doing my dissertation collecting garment sewing skills, and I created a selection test that I think would be, I thought would be appropriate for this company, and given that, it looked like that it would increase, if they used my selection process, they would have hired better people and improved plant productivity by 10%, which is a substantial amount to improve plant productivity. So the problem was that they couldn't use it because they didn't have enough applicants. It was so hard to find people that were willing to sew, contract sewing. Who the hell wants to do this, right? It's a really boring and repetitive job, and the pay was only so-so. You could do very well if you were really fast and basically didn't think about what you were doing. You just lived in a dream world of sewing, I guess, or whatever. In that case, if they had plenty of applicants, my selection tool, which included the MBTI, you guys know Myers-Briggs type inventory, do you still have to take it coming in as a freshman? Well, they used to have to do it. And it would have improved scores enough that the scores indicated that I could get people who would perform a total increase in productivity by 10%, which is pretty cool. All right, so then we hopefully have this test or the one finding, we come down to one that works for us and is adequate predictive ability. Of course, we want to keep looking for better predictability. Particularly in a competitive environment, we want better and better people. So just because we find one test that works doesn't mean we're not going to continue to look for ways to improve that test score and then get from it a better performance appraisal X number of months out. But this is the method that we need to rely on, and it's ongoing you should be using. And once you get one in place, you would then use the test, this test that you checked out, this test, as you kept trying to find a better test, this test would become the existing test, and you take a new test and try and, you know, ramp up your accuracy. Everybody follow this? So the new becomes the old, et cetera, in this case. All right, so no matter what we go into talking about today, and we'll talk about application blanks and interviews, we're talking about tools that can weed people out. Application blanks are used to weed people out, and of course interviews are used to weed people out. That means that we need to investigate the validity of those two selection tools. We're also going to do psychological. I'm not going to do it here, but I'm just saying if you're using interviews, you should be concerned about the validity of those interviews. And I'll talk to you about how to improve your interview process. But the statistical aspects of it are still going to be similar to this. You know, is our interview a good process? Well, let's hire some using a new interview process versus an old interview process, collect scores, and see what happens. Do you see what I mean? The interview would become part of a predictive methodology. The old method we continue to use to bring people in, but they have new interview results, and we'd see how that worked. Okay? So, ready to follow me? Are you awake? Are you awake? See, the people that don't nod, I know are asleep. Propping their heads up. Okay, so let's talk about some of this stuff. First, of course, in the selection process, you're well familiar with the first thing that you're going to see, which is some form of application blank. And you should be able to see right off the bat that the application blank is a selection tool. How is it a selection tool, Dr. Fox? Well, think about all the ways that you could be screened out from using a application blank. The company could look at it and decide that you weren't fit for a particular job. Where do your application blanks come from now? Do you call them up and say, I want an application blank? Please send it to me. Here's my address. Where do you get application blanks for jobs now?
Online.
Online, which implies a certain amount of savoir-faire, knowing how to do it, savoir-faire when it comes to running the Internet, right? You need to be able to go. You need to download Adobe documents. You need to be able to print them. You need to be able to sign them quite often, et cetera, et cetera. And so in that situation, you're being screened right off the bat to see if you're at least mildly tech competent. Right away, we have a possible bias, right? Because it could be a job that requires no technical skills whatsoever, and yet they're weeding out people who can't figure out how to download an Adobe and print it and sign it. Okay, so if it's a job that doesn't require internet usage, we already have a biased, non-job-related weeding out process. So be careful here. I mean, it may be nice to think that we need tech people, but it isn't always required that all jobs are tech savvy. Okay, so the application blank, of course, is going to ask for background data and various other things here. Your education, et cetera, et cetera. Right off the bat, they're going to screen this thing based on how well you fill out this form. You know, how neatly have you done it? Have you put the information in the correct line? This is where I get completely messed up constantly. You've got a form. It's got lines like this on it. And on this line, it says right here, name. Where does your name go? I'm totally baffled by this. And I don't know the answer. But it seems like I always have the wrong answer. Does it go here, or does it go here? I don't know. I'm just saying, I get confused on these things, too, when I see this stuff. Because this thing's used for all kinds of stuff aside from application blanks. But print a bunch of copies, yeah, right, so you can sort of work it out and see where it ends up. If you end up down here with an empty line at the bottom that has a name there, and you've already put something above it, well, that's wrong. You've got to start over again and fill it in correctly to show that you're neat, organized, and you understand the technology. So application blank right there is requiring people to be neat and organized. Are there any jobs where neat and organized doesn't count? Right here, buddy. Raise your hand. Neat and organized? There must be somebody around here that's that way, but it ain't me. Okay, and yet here I am 26 years later, still not fired. All right, so what we have here is the possibility of, again, another non-job-related criteria. People getting chucked because they couldn't fill out a form correctly, which could be a certain weakness. Down through the educational process, down into a section here that you might find a little bit strange. These sections here are usually, all of this here is probably used for almost all their jobs. Seldom do they print up separate applications for, you know, every single job. I have clusters of jobs that have the same type of application. But in any case, this is usually your personal stuff, this is your background, and this often is going to be equal employment opportunity information, which is to say, what protected groups are you? So they're going to ask you, what PG are you? And this runs from your military service to whether or not you're disabled, whether or not you're white, Hispanic, African American, Asian, whatever, et cetera. Why are they doing this, by the way? Come on, it's not that late. It's only 4 o'clock.
To show that they're an equal employment company?
To gather information to show that they're an equal employment organization. So this information is gathered for the federal government, for the, quite often that's a perforation that can be torn off and mailed in to show them, you know, here are the people that we screened and here is their response, or we tear it off and gather it ourselves. But the it's very important to have a disclaimer here saying that we don't use this information to hire people, but it's required by the federal government. Sometimes that form will be coming to you via your mail address or email, for that matter, asking these questions completely separately a few days later. But still, they need to gather this information so they get a picture of the relevant job market, relevant labor market, and the representation within that relevant labor market of the various protected groups. So this information is gathered so that the company can supply information to the government, which is then used if there happens to be an adverse impact claim. You don't have a certain number of people represented that you should have, et cetera, et cetera. Or the government might say, we have data on who you should have at your plant, or who you should have at this particular level in your company, or whatever. This is the data. You should have X number, X number, X number, or X number of these particular protected group subgroups. You can say, well, that's not what we found. We covered the relevant labor market with advertising, and these are the applications we got, and this is the makeup that we got of our applicants. And it's not the same as what you have in your Bureau of Labor Statistics data. You follow me? All right. So if you have this data, it helps protect you against the government using its data. And I told you the EOC is an advocate for the person who's making a complaint. And so they're going to be pushing their view of what the relevant labor market makeup was. If you have this compiled, you can say, well, that may be, but this, after advertising, this is who we got. So from our point of view, the relevant labor market is this, not the Bureau of Labor Statistics data. So it's a good defense for you to have. When you're compared, you want to be compared to your applicant pool, not to some sort of ephemeral data that they got out of the Census Bureau, in my opinion. Okay, another part that you might see on this application blank is called biodata. Biodata is what appears to be seemingly unrelated to the application process. It doesn't seem like it would be job-related, but is, or at least it was up until the mid-80s, and I haven't read any more on it since then, is, at the time, the most highly valid tool that we have, biodata, interestingly enough, not counting previous work done. If you have a person who's applying for exactly the same job that they've done at another company, and you use their performance appraisal at the other company, that's going to be the most accurate thing you can get. Or their attendance record, or how well they got along with their cohorts, or whatever. Previous job experience, as a predictor of future job experience, is the number one thing you can do, but biodata is number two. With a correlation of about 0.660, a very high correlation for a single measure. Biodata is personal. Background data. They ask you questions about your background. Interesting. Were you raised on a farm or in a city? Did you have a large number of brothers and sisters? What did you do for hobbies, etc.? Can you see how this would work? If you were raised with a lot of brothers and sisters, chances are you would be better at jobs that require
sharing,
interpersonal skills, teamwork, any of those things. Okay. On the other hand, if you were raised on a farm and your only friend out there on the farm was Bossy the cow, and you'd pull Bossy into the barn and leap out of the hayloft onto Bossy's back and gallop around the paddock, right, with Bossy, and then you'd get off, you'd be all tired and run down, and you'd say to Bossy, old friend, time to get milk, and she'd say, well, I can see you're tired, you just hold on and I'll jump up and down. That would be a real friend in that situation, right? It takes a while for that to sort of trickle across the class, and I can tell who's awake and who is on the results to that rather pathetic but somewhat amusing image of you holding on and Bossy jumping up and down. I sort of like it. Anyway, so a country person, I know, me too. Hey, look, it's 4 o'clock. Okay. Well, I usually 2 o'clock too, so there's really no excuse. I just keep beating that damn joke over and over again. There's no way. So, a person who's raised on a farm who would have less interpersonal skills, right? Less teamwork, ability, blah, blah. But they might be more self-reliant, might be better problem solvers, et cetera. Who knows? Where is this data gathered from? Where do you think they get the measures that they want for certain types of jobs? Come on. Where would they get it?
Past employees?
Existing employees.
Oh, yeah.
Ask the existing employees to fill out this questionnaire about their hobbies, siblings, where they were raised, blah, blah, and then you would look for consistent measures across that group of successful employees to see if there's any common background points that you could use. And it is remarkably useful. And it may seem strange you fill this out, but you'll think back, hopefully, on this. And remember all the good jokes, but also the information as to why they're asking this stuff. Okay, so this selection process then, starting off with an application blank, the application blank has a number of different points here that could serve. Your education isn't high enough, you're living too far away, right? You don't have a current driver's license, whatever it might happen to be. And when it came to the bio data, that didn't work out for you. You don't match any of our high performers, and any of the categories that our high performers are high in, and so we're not going to consider you. So the selection process starts right here with this application blank and can be a problem. Okay, next step, I would have to say, would be some form of interview, which, as I may have told you, is the most invalid process that we have. It just is not good. It's just not good because of possible biases. They creep in on these interpersonal discussions. If I'm talking to you directly, I'm looking for an Eagles t-shirt. I'm looking for all kinds of background information that might make you a fun person. You want to talk to me about 1965 Camaros and foreign cars and all kinds of stuff, so we have a pleasant conversation, and maybe ways to keep various bugs out of your garden. That's all interesting. Maybe solar arrays, that would be interesting too. So we have lots of interesting points we could talk about, which are not job related, but might pollute my judgment when it comes to determining whether you're going to be the best person for the job. You all understand that. Personal biases. But they're subtle, and they can happen to anybody, right? I've been teaching this for 30 years, probably including grad school, and I still fell for the Eagles license plate. So be careful about this. He's also eager. He's the only one that continued to follow up. But so as you do this, we're looking to create an interview process which is valid, and they're notoriously invalid. And, of course, some research has been done on how to make them better. And here are the points that make interviews better. First, one, we use a panel. Not just one, but several people screening to see whether or not you're appropriate for the job. Let's check and see what this happens to be. I always hope it's videos of our daughter. Panel interviews are like 3 to 4 people, maybe 3 to 5 people, who listen to the applicant respond to job-related questions. Not questions about where they spend their summer vacations, whether or not they like playing t-ball with the kids, whether or not they're into early 60s Porsches or any of that kind of stuff. Instead, we're asking them job-related questions, and from those job-related questions, each panel member will think about the applicant, and after the applicant's left, get together on their results and talk about it, trying to eliminate biases that might be apparent.
Would these be all at the same time? Like, you would be in the room with all 5 people at the same time?
No, just you. Oh, yeah, in the panel, 5 people with 1 applicant.
Yes.
Yeah. For example, Virginia Tech. When I was at Virginia Tech, just in my 6th year, just about to finish up here, master's and PhD, our chairman fell in love with this applicant, a sociologist into a management department. This is not a good thing, in my opinion. But this, our chair thought this guy was the best thing since sliced bread because he got his PhD from Princeton. Whoa, Princeton, Ivy League, Princeton, let's hire him. Walk on Lich, the guy sucks. He doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. Oh, he went to Princeton. He's got to be good. He wasn't. You know, basically, he got no publications out. The students were okay with him, but in general, he didn't fit, and he wasn't there for more than, three years, maybe 4 years, before he quit and went somebody where somebody else loved him as a Princeton grad, but it wasn't Virginia Tech, I hope. It was pretty weird. But talk about a bias. It was absurd. So we get rid of those biases that happened in this panel interview. We asked job-related questions. That's point two. If I walked all the way over there, I'd write two with a circle around it, job-related question mark. Job-related questions. And also, point three is we use a patterned interview, which means everybody gets the same questions. The same questions, which mean, of course, that we're looking at comparing apples to apples, etc., and not having a situation where we can't compare answers because one person we ask about their favorite vacation spot and the other one we ask about whether they enjoy playing t-ball with their kid. Well, whatever. It's fun, but it doesn't necessarily provide useful comparative information. So we need to ask questions that are job-related to, and the panel patterned, rather, questions. So we can actually compare them across job-related questions. And that way, we hope to increase the validity of the selection process, which is notoriously inaccurate. And in large part, I would strongly recommend that you do not make hiring decisions based on an interview. Unless you're following this, and even then I'd be a little concerned. People make a public face that's a lot better than they'll look after the interview and then after the hire because they know what to answer. And they can be, if they've gone through a bunch of interview processes, they know exactly how to conduct themselves. So be careful about this. There's lots of other things you can look at, you should be able to look at, including things like references, and we'll talk about the references and whatnot. The next time we're here. Which will be next Thursday, right?
Yeah.